12. Restoration of a World Islamic Caliphate. The Caliph or successor of Muhammad is the title for a religious and civil head of a Muslim state. The Caliphate represents the political unity, jurisdiction of a Caliph, and leadership under a single Caliph, the commander of the faithful in the Muslim world. When the Turks took control of most Arab lands in 1517, the Ottoman rulers adopted the title Caliph symbolically. 400 years later, the first president of the Turkish republics, Gazi Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, abolished the institution of the Caliphate on March 3, 1924. Since the 1920s, despite a growing interest to re-establishing the Caliphate, the tight restrictions on political activity in most Muslim-ruled countries frustrated process toward restoring Islamic political unity and leadership. Osama bin Laden, leader of Al-Qaeda, called upon the Islamic people to restore the Caliphate, and Hassan al-Banna, the 20th-century founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, also wrote about resurrecting political unity. Bin Laden deeply resented the historic rupture of the Caliphate following the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. He found the Muslim regimes left behind by Western colonizers to be godless, allowing foreigners to meddle in Muslim affairs, and allowed the creation of Israel on Muslim lands. Bin Laden's anger, burning like molten lava pouring from a volcano, was clearly apparent in a video released after the September 11, 2001, attacks. What the United States tastes today is insignificant compared to what we have tasted for tens of years, Osama bin Laden lamented on the video. Our nation has been tasting this humiliation and contempt for more than 80 years. Its sons are being killed, its blood is being shed, its holy places are being attacked, and it is not being ruled according to what God has decreed. It is not surprising that a principal goal of the Al-Qaeda jihadi terrorists is to create a world that is dominated by Muslims, Islam, and Islamic law, the Sharia. Daniel Pipes cited the Daily Telegraph's analysis of Al-Qaeda. Their real project is the extension of the Islamic territory across the globe and the establishment of a worldwide caliphate founded on Sharia law. As one major Al-Qaeda leader put it, due to the blessings of jihad, America's countdown has begun. It will declare defeat soon, to be followed by the creation of a caliphate. Resurgent Islam has emerged as a mortal threat to the capitalist West in the 21st century, and over time it will become an increasingly dangerous geo-religious competitor for world dominance. The world Islamic community stands in opposition to Russia and the United States and their respective strategic partners in its effort to dominate the world. This is a holy war, jihad, whose strengths are drawn from deeply held from religious convictions and passions. George Weigel of the Ethics and Public Policy Center states the simple reality of the ongoing global geopolitical competition. Jihadism is the enemy in the multi-front war that has been declared upon us. And jihadism, Weigel quotes Richard John Neuhaus's writing, is the religiously inspired ideology, which teaches that it is the moral obligation of all Muslims to employ whatever means are necessary to compel the world's submission to Islam. There are certain things about the 9/11 attacks that we cannot not understand, George Weigel writes. For unless we grasp the character of this new kind of war, its religious and ideological roots, the passions that have grown from those roots, and our current vulnerabilities to those passions, our chances of prevailing against an adversary with a radically different view of the human future and a willingness, even eagerness, to die for the sake of hastening that future are weakened. Islamic identity in the early 21st century has been shaped from what is seen as the success of jihad in defeating the Soviet Union in Afghanistan during the 1980s and in taking advantage of America's shocking unpreparedness, in preventing the 9/11 hijackings/aerial suicide bombings and the anthrax attacks that followed. None of this should be surprising. Islam has been almost continuously at war with Christendom since the 7th century, George Weigel reminds us. And it has placed the survival of the West in jeopardy at least twice over 1,000 years of history until its devastating defeat at the Battle of Vienna in 1683. This event triggered a 500-year decline of the Islamic world, lasting until the 1990s. The contemporary jihad is not unlike Islam's historically continuous war against the West. Noting that American education has not done its job of informing Americans of the teachings of the world's religions, George Weigel writes that a West that does not take religious ideas seriously as a dynamic force in the world's unfolding history is a West that will have disarmed itself, conceptually and unimaginatively, in the midst of war. It is difficult for Americans to come to terms with the idea of being at war with the politics of a religion, Islam. It is even more complex, since not all Muslims are at war against the capitalist West. One must be careful of making unfair generalizations. The truth of the matter is the United States is at war with a highly dangerous, influential doctrinal school of Islam, Saudi Arabia's Salafism, as well as other Islamist groups that have joined the international jihad against the capitalist West. Americans and Europeans must remain clear that the enemy is not all Muslims, but only those conducting jihad against us and those that may be supporting them. Since the jihadists do not wear uniforms nor badges giving their affiliation, Europeans and Americans are placed at a severe disadvantage. One can never be certain just who is and who is not a jihadist at war with the West. This dilemma is not lost on the jihadists and their clandestine supporters. Regardless of the mixed picture of Islamist hostility toward the West, it remains a fact. Weigel reminds us that we are facing an obligatory holy war of conquest, which is to be waged until Allah's sovereignty is acknowledged by the entire world. The West did not start terrorist attacks, poverty is not the cause of jihadism, and Israel is not responsible for jihadism. It is not Islamophobic to note the historical connection between conquest and Muslim expansion, or between contemporary jihadism and terrorism. Akbar Ahmed, a highly respected professor of Islamic studies at American University, makes a point about the difficulty facing Westerners confronting jihad. Professor Ahmed opened his 2007 book, Journey into Islam, with a quotation by the politest of young men who said to him during a visit to South Asia, "The actions of Osama bin Laden, Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Taliban, even if they kill women and children, are perfectly justified by Islam." Emphasis and original. In light of such anti-Western hatred and willingness of Islamists to kill, often indiscriminately, the one thing that Americans and Europeans can do, as recommended by Robert Spencer, is to stop insisting that Islam is a religion of peace. Islam was not a religion of peace in Muhammad's time. Islam is not today. Islam in the early 21st century is not of one piece. Many Islamic interpretations support jihad and death to the Western world, while many sit in the grandstands cheering on the killers and offering a sweet face of peace to Westerners. Most Muslims are content to worship Islam in a world of religious freedom. But the reality remains, Islam does not teach the golden rule to help its adherents guide their lives. Jesus's dictum that, "Whatever you wish men would do to you, do so to them," Matthew 7 verse 12, appears in virtually every religious tradition on the planet, except Islam, Robert Spencer explains. The Quran and Hadith make such a sharp distinction between believers and unbelievers that there is no room for any commandment of beneficence. Waleed Fares offers another piece of the jihad puzzle. "The United States was not attacked randomly," Fares writes, "but as a part of a planned offensive war. The 9/11 attacks were not an action by a small group of deranged, out-of-control extremists," Fares explains. "They were a prelude of future attacks to come, in pursuit of clearly defined goals." Religious passion. A brief excursion into the historical and theological roots of jihadism is necessary to gain at least a sense of the past world power and religious passions motivating the jihadists to oppose the West. Such sensings offer insight into the specific nature of the jihadi threat posed against Western culture today. In 100 years of warfare, AD 632 to 732, Arab conquest extended like the body of a huge eagle-like caliphate with its body resting in Iraq, with one wing reaching across Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India to the Chinese border, and the other across Palestine, North Africa, and the Iberian Peninsula and into southern France. It was from this central position in Iraq and Palestine that the Arabs won victory after victory over the Byzantines and Persians. Arabs enjoyed high morale, superior mobility, support of the native populations, and the crumbling weaknesses of the existing empires. The Arabs lost momentum after 732 as a result of Byzantine resurgence that allowed it to take the battle to the Arabs and the combat strength of the Wire Turks that blocked Arab expansion into the Chinese Empire. The efforts by Charlemagne in the West provided a barrier to the fourth Arab expansion into Europe. At the same time, Arab disunity drained the caliphate's fighting capacity. Taymiyyah, Wahhabism, Salafism, and the Muslim Brotherhood are complementary in their 800-year common goal of restoring Islam's golden era under a world caliphate and their willingness to follow a path of violent jihad to win this profoundly religious objective. The idea that violent jihad was necessary to assure the survival of Islam was first expressed in the late 13th and early 14th centuries by Ahmed ibn Abd al-Halim ibn Taymiyyah, 1263-1328. He taught that the political power could be restored over the lands and Muslim communities conquered by the Mongols through the power of the sword wielded with the religious passion of jihad. This passion for jihad included absolute hatred for heretics, apostates, hypocrites, sinners, and unbelievers, including Christians and Jews. Wahhabism and Salafism began as two distinct trains of thought. Saudi King Faisal embraced Salafi pan-Islamism, which resulted in an integrated doctrine based on Ibn Abd al-Wahhab's teachings and Salafi interpretations of the sayings of Muhammad. King Faisal's main objective was one of blocking those who were leaning toward pan-Arabism in favor of pan-Islamism. It also created, however, radicalized Salafi constituency elements, which were funded by the Saudis through the Muslim World League in 1962. The West needs to be aware of the fact that Saudi students in the 1970s learned engineering and administration alongside an ideology of xenophobic alienation, Trevor Stanley warned. In the long run, the battle against violent Salafism will be fought not only on the battlefields of Afghanistan and Iraq, but also in the universities of the Middle East. 16 is in all wars, the battle of ideas reigns supreme over the sword. The Salafists believe that the first generation of Muslims during Muhammad's time and the two generations following offer an example of how Islam should be practiced. Current-day Salafists believe that materialist and cultural influences have distorted the purity of Islam as it was practiced during the days of Muhammad. They believe that an Islamic revival will purge religious innovation that has weakened Islam. By cleansing Islam of changes made to its doctrine over time, the Salafists believe they can restore Islam to the three generations during Muhammad's time. Many current-day Salafi point to Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, 1703-1792. As being the first modern era figure to advocate a return to the religious practices of the righteous predecessors. His evangelizing in the 18th century called upon Saudi Arabia for a return to the religious practices of the early generations. His works are read by Salafists today. Osama bin Laden and his followers think and operate in the tradition of the Salafists, whose main goal was to return Islam to its golden age under the Prophet Muhammad and the first caliphs. The Salafi ideology, called Al-Aqida al-Islamiyya al-Salafiyya, Waleed Fares explains, is grounded in the works of many clerics, chronicles, imams, and a panoply of leaders. The emergence of the contemporary Salafi Sunni jihadi is focused on the specific strategic objective of restoration of the caliphate. The Saudis and Wahhabism claim to be the leader of all Sunni Muslims, slightly more than 1 billion people worldwide. In the Salafi tradition, the Saudis/Wahhabists reject all innovations in Islam after the 3rd Islamic century, or about 950 AD, and their main focus is on maintaining the purity of Islam as it existed at that time. Other Muslim groups, however, deny the Wahhabi/Salafi claim to represent pure Islam. Wahhabism evolved from the teachings of Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, a Sunni cleric, who in the mid to late 18th century established the Salafist movement in the remote desert areas of the Arabian Peninsula. Islam, Wahhab taught, must be preserved in ways that are consistent with and supportive of the Prophet Muhammad's teachings. Since the Salafi after Muhammad established a caliphate to continue his ways, so too should the Muslim government opposing Ottoman power. Wahhab joined with the bandit al-Sa'd who wielded the cutting edge of the sword against the Turks, whose power had been extended across the Arabian Peninsula. Al-Sa'd's ancestors and followers of Wahhab kept up the fight into the 20th century. In the end, with the help of World War I that crushed remaining Ottoman power, the peninsula was freed and Saudi Arabia became an Islamic state. Wahhabism, since, has become a pillar of legitimacy for the Saudi Arabian monarchy. The Muslim Brotherhood is a second movement of Salafi jihadists, began to come together in Egypt during the 1920s. Guided by Salafism and jihadism, the Brotherhood was an urban group whose long-term objective was to take over the government. Hassan Albana, strongly influenced by his mentor Muhammad Rashid Rida, emerged as the major organizer behind Egyptian fundamentalism. When he organized the Brotherhood, its credo was, God is our objective, the Quran is our constitution, the Prophet is our leader, struggle is our way, and death for the sake of God is the highest of our aspirations. An Egyptian schoolteacher, Hassan al-Banna, founded the Muslim Brotherhood, or the Society of Muslim Brothers, in 1928 to promote implementing the Quran Sharia law and social renewal. Al-Banna was opposed to the political and social injustices he witnessed and encouraged an Islamic ethos of altruism and civic duty. By the 1940s, the Brotherhood had about 500,000 members. Saad Qutb visited the United States as a student between 1948 to 1951. Appalled by the racism and sexual permissiveness he encountered, Qutb returned to Egypt with a burning hatred of the West and its society. He joined the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood and would become one of its most outspoken jihadists. Qutb has an extensive influence on jihadist groups in Egypt in showing his hatred of the West. Since the Muslim Brotherhood was also connected with jihadists in Saudi Arabia, there can be little doubt about his influence on Osama bin Laden. During the 1950s, the Muslim Brotherhood was a leader of political opposition to Egyptian strongman and socialist Gamal Abdel Nasser, which included assassination attempts. Many Brotherhood members were driven out of the country and found refuge in Saudi Arabia. Wahhabism had long been a mentor for al-Banna. The relationship coalesced during the Egyptian exile in Saudi Arabia when many similarities, as well as differences with Wahhabi, were discovered and often resolved. Over time, the two fundamentalist approaches began to meld, and the Wahhabi spread its message through the Muslim Brotherhood. Saad Qutb, 1903-1966, an Egyptian, became a leading ideologue of Muslim fundamentalism, and he was also a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Sent to the United States in late 1949 to mid-1950, Qutb apparently was shocked, as Bernard Lewis explains, by the strong support for Israel he found in America. His outlook doubtlessly was partially shaped by the formation of the Israeli state and diplomatic recognition by Washington. But Qutb, Lewis recounts, saw events as a Jewish onslaught on Islam, with Christian complicity. Qutb taught that Islam is a religion of peace, Robert Spencer observes. But to Qutb, Spencer continues, Islam is a religion of the peace that will come when everyone is Muslim or at least subject to the Islamic State. And to establish that peace, Muslims must wage war. The United States and Israel are first in line. In the 2000s, Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood remained united by strategy but divided by tactics. According to Lydia Khalil, Al-Qaeda's number two leader Ayman al-Zawahiri denounced the Muslim Brotherhood for what he believed was a misguided direction toward political Islam. The issue was over the Brotherhood's participation in Egypt's parliamentary elections. Al-Zawahiri's criticism was drawn from his militant Salafist perception that participation in the elections put the Brotherhood in position for pursuing the goal of Islamic governance at the expense of jihad. For Wahhabis, the ideal world occurred at the time of the Prophet Muhammad when he shared the teachings of the Quran with the tribes of the Arabian Peninsula. The task of contemporary Wahhabists and their Salafist brothers is to resurrect those earliest days with a restored caliphate that ruled the Islamic world after the Prophet's death in 632 AD. At the acme of its power, the caliphate's hegemony stretched across the territories of northern Africa, Portugal into France, and across to northern India, through the Balkans and into Poland, Hungary, and Austria. The caliphate's governance held strictly to Islam's religious code prescribed by Allah, the Sharia. But for the Wahhabis/Salafists, fundamentalism is not just about imposing the Sharia. Seeing the world through a novel Islamic lens permits them to see Islam as being not just a religion, Francis Olivier Roy explains, but it is also a political ideology encompassing all aspects of society, including politics, law, economy, social justice, foreign policy, and other major areas of contemporary society. Islamism, Roy says, is the brand of modern political Islamic fundamentalism which claims to recreate a true Islamic society. Emphasis added, the new world envisioned would convert all people around the globe to Islam. Those who refused to convert would be relegated to an existence of extreme harshness. Many would be slain. From these early influences of Taymiyyah and al-Wahhab, al-Banna and Qutb, and Salafism emerged as the current-day jihad. Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden, an Egyptian and a Saudi, joined forces in the creation of al-Qaeda and the global jihad. Islamic Caliphate. Muhammad, 570-632, was a man of war turned prophet. When he ordered his followers to fight for the new religion he had delivered to them, some of the tribes rejected his entreaties in favor of worshiping their own gods. Shouting invectives, Muhammad picked up the sword and attacked the recalcitrant until they succumbed to his rule and Islam. Forcible conversions were not made, although those who did not willingly subscribe to Islam were compelled to live as non-Muslims in an Islamic system that gave all support to Muslims and oppressed those who would not convert. Once his base was assured, Muhammad turned to using the sword to spread the word of Islam. According to the Quran, the surest path to paradise would be found by those who slay and are slain for Allah. Over time, Christian lands fell quickly to the massive Islamic armies that pounced upon them, wielding the sword for Allah. Christian North Africa, Portugal, Spain into France, across to Armenia, Cyprus, Rhodes, Crete, and Sicily. Muslim leaders encouraged obedience to the rule of the caliph by reaching into the Quran to echo the words of God. When you meet the unbelievers in the battlefield, strike off their heads and, when you have laid them low, bind your captives firmly. 47:4. Islam has no moral code similar to the Ten Commandments. Hence, just about anything can be justified if it contributes to the spread of Islam. Muslims are required to speak the truth with other believers, but not unbelievers. Muslims can be friendly with non-Muslims, but they cannot be friends. To step across this boundary, Muslims would risk falling afoul of the Quran's 3:28, admonishment to guard yourselves from them, non-believers. Many contemporary Islamists want to restore the caliphate in order to unify the Muslim peoples against the West. By reimposing the Sharia, they believe, the historical caliphate can be restored. From this centralized base, Wahhabism, Sunni, can underwrite jihad to suppress and convert the people of non-Muslim states until Islamic rule is imposed worldwide. Restoring the caliphate by turning the clock back to the 7th century is an interesting vision. But today's instant global communications, especially travel, television, and the internet, provide an alternative perspective. Both its, the United States, low form of girly magazines and punk rock, as well as its impressive literature, art, commerce, and technology now saturate the world. And why not? Victor Davis Hansen asks. American radical individualism appeals to the innate human desires for freedom and unbridled expression. Westernization, he says, subverts most hierarchs, especially in the reactionary world of Islamic fundamentalism, where the mullah, family patriarch, or state autocrat can't keep a lid on it. Americans must remain solid in their belief that an intense yearning for individual liberty beats inside all people everywhere. A part of realization of that liberty is given expression in a profound respect for people of all religions and those who do not believe. Every opportunity should be taken to invite Muslims to join in this fundamental expression of human liberty. The Islamist's nightmare is fear of change, fear of a secular world that would disconnect the political state from religious law. They fear democracy and equal rights for women. They fear liberty. Hence, a despotic caliphate that keeps the Islamic peoples marooned in the 8th century is the Islamists' answer to all of these fears. Their solution is to eliminate Western liberal democracies that block the roadway for Islam's political and social change throughout the world. Already they have made headway, especially in Europe where Islamization and the creation of Eurabia are feeding the Islamist wolves at Europe's door. Saudi Arabia's religious fifth column is already grounded inside the United States, Chapter 13, while the Wahhabi theology is used to undermine of American liberties and democracy. The cultural war against the United States, supplemented by the sword of terrorism, is both a strategy and grand tactic to break down the American will to resist domination by the rule of Islam, including its religious law, civil code, and system of governance under a world caliphate. The false idol of multiculturalism, a concept contrived to support the radical left's assault on American culture, self-destructs when it is exposed to the realism of militant Islam's perceptions of the West. The cultural chasm is massive between the American way of life, individual liberty, and democracy, and Islam's civil code of a restricted social intercourse, autocratic laws and the Sharia, and a worldwide governing system, the caliphate. As explained by Islamic scholar Bernard Lewis, The most powerful accusation of all against the United States is the degeneracy and debauchery of the American way of life and the threat that it offers to Islam. These perceived threats to Islam, Professor Lewis explains, are articles of faith in Muslim fundamentalist circles. Osama bin Laden, for instance, after watching people come and go in early 1980s Beirut, commented that this is a small America, with its kafir, infidels, filth, and whores, but soon things will change. In February 1998, after witnessing American society and lack of what he perceived as moral values, bin Laden said, "All these crimes and sins committed by the Americans are a clear declaration of war on Allah, His Messenger, and Muslims." When multiculturalism is confronted by Muslim theocracy and its fear of pluralistic liberty in the West's openness, respect for women, and culture founded on the principles of individual liberty flourishing in a robust democracies, the idea that all cultures are equal collapses on the basis of its own pseudo-logic. A cultural war is raging alongside the military conflict between Islamists and the West. The so-called war on terror is one of culture and of the sort. This demands that Americans engage Islamic fascists shouting death to infidels with a clear cultural message, as well as military engagement. The abolishment of the caliphate in 1924, or the Sultanate as it was known at the time, broke the continuous rule of Sunni Islam, though accommodating many changes along the way that reached all the way back to Muhammad's death in 632 AD. These 14 centuries stand in silent testimony to Islam's role as a crucial symbol of Muslim unity, which became important to Muslim identity across the centuries. As a consequence, Professor Lewis says, contemporary Muslims tend to see not a nation subdivided into religious groups, but a religion subdivided into nations. This Islamic perspective of the religion flourishing in different lands has brought it into conflict with the West, whose nation-states exist on the basis of Western values and evolution of these territories under Western principles of international law. It should not be surprising that, when the West looks toward Islamic countries and their doctrine of autocratic rule under a world caliphate, it sees something akin to fascism. President George W. Bush used the phrase Islamic fascists to describe those terrorists who plotted to blow up some 10 airliners over the Atlantic in August 2006. His remarks set off a mini-flap. The Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE, a well-heeled, Saudi-funded Sunni lobbyist, was apoplectic over the president linking Islam and fascism. Although the harshness of Islamic fascism may rankle American senses a bit, it is a very descriptive phrase that accurately characterizes the religiously based Wahhabi political assault on Western societies. The iron hand of the restored caliphate envisioned by Osama bin Laden would certainly be used to clean up Osama's perceptions of filth and whores in American society and the West at large. Extreme social regimentation would relegate Jews and Christians to a subculture of second-class residents in the newly conquered Muslim lands, and those persons belonging to the Hindu and other religions would receive even harsher treatment, perhaps genocide. Make no mistake, the United States is at war, and from the Islamic fascist point of view, it is a war to the death. Americans need to look behind the bombs and hijackings to the religious roots of Islamist behavior in order to better understand their motivation and how best to combine the West's counterculture war and the sword to neutralize al-Qaeda's strengths. Jihad. The Quran is the central authority of Islam. Muslims believe the Quran was dictated by Allah and delivered to the Prophet Muhammad by the angel Gabriel. The roots of what it means to be a Muslim by the 1.2 billion believers around the world are secured deeply in this sacred text. Islamic law, beliefs, and spiritual and ethical teachings are drawn from it. It is not surprising, therefore, that the Quran's authority is very strong, politically and socially in the Muslim world. Muslims today, as in the beginning, believe that the Quran is literally the word of God. Everything in the Quran's approximately 80,000 words, between 6,200 and 6,240 verses, and 114 surahs is expressed in perfect Arabic and is considered eternal and created by the great God. An important aspect of the Quran is that it dictates civil law, the Sharia, assuring a fusion of state power and religious practices that continue to exist today. The caliph in the past was believed to be chosen by Allah to lead his people. Muslim societies are not all alike, which has created political and religious differences and inconsistencies. Transnational extremist movements are dedicated to restoring world Islam in a caliphate that would reclaim past Islamic lands, as well as extend the caliph's hegemony over lands held by non-believers. The caliphate, the extremists believe, would assure the political and social regimentation necessary for the Sharia civil code to assure Muslim unity in spite of cultural differences. Strict interpretation of the Quran provides the code of conduct for carrying out such action. Israel's Dor Gold presents a discomforting picture of Saudi Arabia's contemporary religious teachings. Saudi mosques were serving in the 1990s as centers of vicious incitement, according to which Christianity was a distorted and tolerated religion. Interfaith dialogue was called sinful, and it was forbidden for man to bring together Islam and blasphemy, monotheism and polytheism, and Allah's straight path of righteousness and the satanic path of heresy. Since Christians and Jews were infidels, it was permissible, according to Saudi religious textbooks, to demolish, burn, and destroy their bastions. The idea of jihad is central to all that is Islam. The first recorded political use of jihad took place in the 7th century during the military consolidation under the Prophet Muhammad. From the beginning, Muslims established the rule of Islam to conquered peoples under the guidance of jihad. Theology and politics were one. So important was jihad regarded as an instrument of Islam that the early Muslim leaders considered it a sixth unofficial pillar of Islam. The five pillars of faith are witness, prayer, pilgrimage, almsgiving, and fasting. Jihad has always held the connotation that all Muslims accepted duty to spread the word of Islam. The theology and practical use of jihad in spreading Islam is well rooted in the Quran. 9:73, O Prophet, strive against the disbelievers and the hypocrites. Be harsh with them. Their ultimate abode is hell, a hapless journey's end. 9:123, O ye who believe, fight those of the disbelievers who are near to you, and let them find harshness in you, and know that Allah is with those who keep their duty unto Him. 2:191, and slay them whenever you catch them, and turn them out from where they have turned you out, such is the reward of those who suppress faith. 8:12, I will instill terror into the hearts of the unbelievers, smite you above their necks, smite all their fingertips off them. 8:15, 16, O ye who believe, when you meet the unbelievers in hostile array, never turn your back to them. If any to turn his back to them on such a day, unless it be in a stratagem of war, or retreat to do a troop of his own, draws on himself the wrath of Allah, and his abode is hell, an evil refuge, indeed. 8:39, and fight them on until there is no more tumult or oppression, and there prevail justice and faith in Allah altogether and everywhere. But if they cease, verily Allah doth see all that they do. The jihad ideology defines enemies as those infidels who oppose the establishment or spread of Islam over the lands under their control or sovereignty. Spreading the faith by the power of the sword is an important duty to growing numbers in the contemporary Muslim world. The jihadists are religious devotees, and their actions are rooted in the measures that led to the creation of the first Islamic state for them 13 centuries ago. History serves as a guiding light for today's jihadists as they move toward restoration of the caliphate and engineering a reality that will allow Islam to embrace the entire world. In the universal Islamic polity as conceived by Muslims, there is no Caesar but only God, who is the sole sovereign and the sole source of law, Islamic scholar Bernard Lewis tells us. Muhammad was his prophet, who during his lifetime both taught and ruled on God's behalf. Osama bin Laden declared war on the Western world on February 23, 1998, in his Declaration of the World Islamic Front for Jihad against the Jews and the Crusaders. First, bin Laden presented three facts that are known to everyone. These facts are used by bin Laden to create a phony script to underwrite the rationale for his declaration and ensure that it met the Quran's 7th century criteria for making war. First, for over 7 years, the United States has been occupying the lands of Islam in the holiest of places, the Arabian Peninsula, plundering its riches, dictating to its rulers, humiliating its people, terrorizing its neighbors, and turning its bases in the peninsula into a spearhead through which to fight the neighboring Muslim peoples. Second, despite the great devastation inflicted on the Iraqi people 1990-1991 by the Crusader Zionist Alliance, and despite the huge number of those killed, which has exceeded 1 million, despite all this, The Americans are once again trying to repeat the horrific massacres, as though they are not content with the protracted blockade imposed after the ferocious war on the fragmentation and devastation. Third, if the Americans' aims behind these wars are religious and economic, the aim is also to serve the Jews' petty state and divert attention from its occupation of Jerusalem and murder of Muslims there. The best proof of this is their endeavor to fragment all the states in the region, such as Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Sudan, into paper statelets, and through their disunion and weakness to guarantee Israel's survival and the continuation of the brutal crusade occupation of the peninsula. All these crimes and sins committed by the Americans are a clear declaration of war on Allah, His Messenger, and Muslims, bin Laden says in a sweeping conclusion. Osama bin Laden dropped the first shoe. On that basis, and in compliance with Allah's order, we issue the following fatwa, ruling, to all Muslims, the ruling to kill all Americans and their allies, civilian and military. Is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it, in order to liberate the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Holy Mosque, Mecca, from their grip, and in order for their armies to move out of all the lands of Islam, defeated and unable to threaten any Muslim. Osama bin Laden's theological interpretation was a stroke of genius. Not only did he put the West and Israel on notice and open the door for development of a broader global girdling terror network, but he checkmated any meaningful opposition by moderate Muslims. Robert Spencer explains, bin Laden's theory of jihad allows for the unchecked growth of militant groups in Islam, growth which outmanned and outgunned Islamic moderates are powerless to stop, because to do so would be to turn Islam against itself. Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was developed and flourished during the 1980s to bring Arab fighters into Afghanistan for the jihad against the Soviet Union for having seized Muslim land. 2 years following the 1989 exit of the Soviets, the Persian Gulf War erupted, with infidels once again on Muslim lands. Those foreign military forces based in Saudi Arabia were especially repugnant to Wahhabis. Since Saudi territory was the home of two of Islam's most revered holy sites, Medina and Mecca, thanks to the quiet acceptance of terrorism by the Clinton administration and its ineffective responses, and in some cases no response at all to the terrorist attacks during the 1990s, Osama bin Laden was emboldened to take more drastic steps. President Clinton's choice to view Al-Qaeda a terrorist acts as being nettlesome matters suitable for law enforcement, FBI, and prosecution strengthened Osama bin Laden's view of the U.S. being a weak horse. With America's security door left open by the Clinton administration, the September 11th attacks were inevitable. Many American counterterrorism specialists in the 1990s advocated more direct responses, but their strong recommendations were brushed off by the administration. The only question open was where and when the big attack would occur. There were many lonely voices trying to persuade the Clinton administration to address terrorism as attacks on the sovereignty of the United States. Chasing down militant terrorists internationally is a soldier's job, not a policeman's, was the message offered by numerous counterterrorism specialists in the 1990s. The rationale was simple: assigning the counterterrorism job to law enforcement, though a couple of notable arrests and convictions were made, was insufficient to place the Al-Qaeda organization nor Osama bin Laden personally at risk. In bin Laden's eyes, firing a few missiles at a base camp in Afghanistan and a roll of the dice chance of killing him was another weak horse move. The situation was worsened by Clinton officials blabbing as to why they thought Osama was at the targeted Afghanistan camp in the first place. Result: loss of a valuable intelligence source. Al-Qaeda is organized horizontally into a network rather than a vertical organizational chart showing top-down guidance and bottom-up feedback. Hence, chopping off the head of the snake, Osama bin Laden, as some summarize the problem, while important, would not destroy Al-Qaeda. Rather, Al-Qaeda resembles more of an octopus whose tentacles or arms spread out. If one destroys a tentacle, the Al-Qaeda octopus is poised to reconstitute itself. It can survive elimination of operational cells, going on to rebuild replacements. Chameleon-like, Al-Qaeda is forever adapting to changing environments, organizing new fronts to mask its activities, and decentralizing the planning and execution of terrorist attacks against the West. By assisting the radicalization of homegrown terrorists that support the jihad independently, Al-Qaeda has created a wild card, though not under its direct control. Al-Qaeda is a transnational organization or a borderless network of like-minded, though independently organized and led Islamist groups worldwide. It provides important direction in countering what Muslims see as the Western world's anti-Islam actions. While the West as a culture is the target of terrorism, the United States is singled out for particular attention. Al-Qaeda's pan-Islamic agenda also includes mobilizing the Muslim nation or Ummah. Reacting to an increase in the number of enemies after September 11th and a well-founded respect for the destructive power of the weapons arrayed against them, Al-Qaeda leaders encouraged Islamist groups to strike against foreign targets on their own soil, especially Americans and their resources. Sleeper cells may be present inside the United States and Western Europe. The secret groups are believed to have received training from Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Saudi-funded madrasas or religious schools in Pakistan have brainwashed millions of young men to hate America, Israel, and India since the early 1990s. In order to mask its activities in garnering new recruits and supporters, Al-Qaeda operates through mosques, madrasas, and cultural and community centers in the United States and Europe. Al-Qaeda's strategy against the capitalist West. Al-Qaeda's holy war or jihad against the West is well-rooted in Islamic doctrine, which precludes any chance of accommodation. The West's response, however, is not a holy war against Islam per se. But Islam is divided in two parts, one religious and the other political, the latter being the Sharia or civil law and specific infringement of recognized civil liberties, especially those involving treatment of women and totalitarian governance. Wahhabism, the Islamic doctrine guiding Al-Qaeda and its supporting groups, envisions restoration of the caliphate ruling the Islamic world. This is the political aspect of Islam, not the religious dimension. The West must be careful to respect the great world religion of Islam, while countering and defeating the political aspect inherent in Wahhabism. Easy words to scribble, but practically a very difficult task, since the sinews that bind religious and political Islam are not always evident. To some extent, the dual aspect of religious-political Islam is a weak construct, since the two components are fused as one in the Quran and religious clarifications and statements over 1,400 years. But it was Al-Qaeda that emerged from the fires of Salafism to inflict its anti-Western, pan-Islam vision of a world caliphate on non-Muslims. Islam in Al-Qaeda's hands became a religious veil over what is clearly a political agenda of violence and totalitarian rule. Al-Qaeda's strategy is based on waging a war against the West and Islam with the ultimate aim of restoring the traditional caliphate. The strategy demands first driving the Americans out of Iraq. Secondly, gathering numerous allied groups worldwide to assist the conflict in the name of pan-Islamic solidarity and maneuvering to ensure Wahhabist leaders, especially Osama bin Laden, preserve positions of leadership. Thirdly, by extending a jihad to secular countries near Israeli borders. The next step would be creating a successful clash with Israel. Finally, Osama bin Laden would achieve totalitarian control and a restorative of the caliphate that would extend to Islamic domination of the world. Al-Qaeda's decentralized structure helps to attract and nurture new Islamic groups to integrate into the octopus-like network. These groups, scattered across the globe in a multitude of countries, are the building blocks of the full-scale Islamic war to come. Al-Qaeda's training of supporters in urban guerrilla and terrorist tactics, as well as assistance in picking targets, and sometimes resource support all help to build a solid network with loyalty to Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri, and other Islamist leaders. Al-Qaeda's grand strategy is linked closely to its octopus-like network of dispersed sympathizers. These smaller, national-based groups hold a variety of beliefs consistent with Islam, and they are often swayed by Al-Qaeda pronouncements for direct action against the United States. This centralized ideology of Islamic fundamentalism, Wahhabism, and Salafism provides an essential rationale for the decentralized execution of indigenous terrorist attacks against the West. The advent of leaderless terrorism, according to Denis Puchinsky, a former State Department official, was premeditated and has become a permanent component of the global jihad movement. While this indigenous or homegrown terrorism has been growing, Al-Qaeda has retained the capability to execute attacks of its own. Pakistan. Having been pushed out of Afghanistan in 2002, Al-Qaeda and its Taliban allies set up operations in Waziristan, in rugged western Pakistan along the Afghan border. Although world maps show Waziristan being a part of Pakistan, the area is under quasi-control of the Islamabad government. Tribal leaders remain the supreme authorities in Waziristan. Movement from the region into Pakistan per se is quite easy, while entrance to the region from mainstream Pakistan can be made quite difficult by the ruling tribal leaders. This is a perfect area for Al-Qaeda, with ready access to a population filled with angry young men whose anti-Western beliefs make them ready for recruitment. Al-Qaeda is able to maintain clandestine training areas and at the same time have ready access to markets and stores, medical care, state-of-the-art electronic technology. As a bonus, Al-Qaeda faces relaxed security services, and they have ready access to regular air service to the West for foreign trainees and dispatch of terrorist cells. The Islamist Jihad fighters live and operate openly. No one bothers them. Abdul Mujaddal, a Taliban commander wounded in a gun battle with British troops, was evacuated from Afghanistan to Karachi for emergency care. "Until I return to fight, I'll feel safe and relaxed here," he told Newsweek writer Ron Morrow. Pakistan provides a perfect environment for combat jihadists. The country has been under military rule for 40 of its 60 years. More than half of the 160 million people cannot read or write. Annual per capita GDP is about $2,600, or about 75% below the world average. And, without public schools, poor parents send their children, some 2 million of them, to some 13,000 madrasas or Islamic religious schools. The madrasas emphasize memorization of the Quran and serve as recruitment centers for jihad. General Pervez Musharraf and the Pakistani army made a half-hearted effort to eliminate the Al-Qaeda and Taliban infrastructure present along Afghanistan's eastern border. After losing more than 1,000 troops, plus 3,000 wounded and 300 captured, the Pakistani government in 2006 decided to accommodate the jihadist presence. The war on terror took a major step backward when the northwest corner of Pakistan became an untested safe haven for Al-Qaeda, the Afghan Taliban, and outlawed Pakistani jihadists. Pakistan paid its own price for the Al-Qaeda presence. Telecommunications intercepts confirmed that Al-Qaeda members were responsible for the 2007 assassination of presidential candidate Benazir Bhutto, a declared enemy of the jihadists. By early 2008, Western intelligence had concluded that Al-Qaeda had reconstituted its massive network of operatives, logistics, communications, and couriers along the Afghan-Pakistan border. Al-Qaeda's adjustment to the U.S. success in Iraq included instructions for major operatives to leave the country. A renewed focus was being placed on mass casualty attacks in Europe, with special attention placed on Germany and Spain. Illegal immigration in these two countries from Algeria and Morocco will provide the backbone for the planned attacks. The Pakistani government finally recognized that the United States was not the threat and that the cooperation between Al-Qaeda and Pashtun separatism and extremism was a major internal threat. Europe. Among the indigenous terror events carried out independently in Europe within Al-Qaeda guidelines were the urban transit attacks in Madrid in March 2003 by a Moroccan Islamist group and the radicalized British Boys. In London in July 2005. In the meantime, Al-Qaeda money helped to persuade Algeria's Salafist group for combat and call to make its jihadists available for bin Laden's operations. According to a statement by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Algerian Salafist group would be available globally with cells and operations far from North Africa. In addition, Al-Qaeda sleeper cells were developed in Canada, and Saudi money financed Al-Qaeda's takeover of Somalia 2006. In the Balkans, Al-Qaeda network was linked to indigenous groups, though it was a hard sell of Wahhabism meeting the needs of Balkan Muslims. Al-Qaeda fighters, however, for years have quietly infiltrated guerrilla forces in Kosovo, Bosnia, Croatia, and Macedonia. In Pakistan, Al-Qaeda has schools and training facilities for use by foreign terrorists and relies on close relations with the Pakistani Islamist network. Al-Qaeda's operational ties also extend to allied groups in the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, and elsewhere in South and Southeast Asia. Cross-connections with groups in Chechnya, Libya, Egypt, and elsewhere in the Caucasus and North Africa multiply the type and number of terrorist options available to Al-Qaeda planners. In Latin America, Al-Qaeda has a presence in the wide-open and lawless three-border region, which is made up of the cities of Puerto Iguazu, Argentina, Foz do Iguazu, Brazil, and Ciudad del Este, Paraguay. Europe is the favorite foreign lair for the Islamic terrorists. It has been regarded as a safe haven for terrorists who initially infected the host societies like a nasty cancer, and by 2007 they had metastasized into a sword wielded to Islamicize the whole of Europe. Al-Qaeda and its satellite groups find in Europe pliable societies that enable their funding, logistics, planning, and, in limited ways, training. Mosques are sites for radicalization and recruitment for creation of new terror cells. Among the recruits are British, Spanish, and French citizens. In Britain, the use of the phrase Londonistan reflected the fact that, for whatever reason, the children and grandchildren of those brave Britons that stood up to Hitler and endured the Nazi Blitz have seemingly lost their will to stand up to the wicked. One might legitimately suspect that years of pounding by the radical progressive socialist Marxists directed at tearing down the United Kingdom government has exacted a heavy price from British society. The London School of Economics, once a renowned institution of great pedagogical value, for example, was transformed a century ago into an anti-capitalist, anti-Western miseducation center. In recent years, it has had a connection with some of the most brutal terrorists. Multiculturalism and political correctness, as is the case for many U.S. universities, advocated by left-wing professors, journalists, and politicians, further weakened love of country and the will to defend its values and traditional institutions. American journalist Tony Blankley, a clear-thinking, graceful writer with roots in Britain, has gone to great lengths to warn of the impact on the United States if Europe becomes an Islamicized Arabia. The threat of the radical Islamists taking over Europe is every bit as great to the United States as was the threat of the Nazis taking over Europe in the 1940s. We cannot afford to lose Europe. We cannot afford to see Europe transformed into a launching pad for Islamist jihad. London has long been a haven for Al-Qaeda and others in the worldwide network of Islamic terrorism. Between 300 and 600 British citizens passed through Afghan training camps in the 1980s and 1990s. Many Al-Qaeda members and supporters in Saudi Arabia fled to London in the early 1990s when the House of Saud took action to break up dissidents in the kingdom. Meanwhile, the seeds of radical Islam began to take root in Britain and intensified over the years. Integration into the stratified British society was difficult for many Muslims. The apartheid reality in Britain trumped normative left-wing mouthings of multilateralism and political correctness. In 2004, the unemployment rate of Muslims in Britain was about 28%, or a bit more than twice as great as all Britons at nearly 13%. It is not surprising that Al-Qaeda and its followers first penetrated those countries with lax asylum and immigration laws, including Spain, the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, and Italy. Several hundred terrorists took up residence in the Netherlands by 2003.56. The terrorist attacks on the mass transit systems in Madrid on March 11, 2004, and London on July 7, 2005, indicate a shift in Al-Qaeda's strategy. Since being driven out of Afghanistan, it seems Osama bin Laden and his terrorist gang are finding direct attacks on Western targets more difficult. By enabling vicious attacks without Al-Qaeda's hands-on involvement by satellite terrorist groups, including homegrown terrorists, Al-Qaeda remains the head of the octopus while giving independence of action by its tentacles. In Madrid, for example, it is most likely that a Moroccan group with ties to Islamic Combat Group and Al-Qaeda bombed the commuter trains. In London, the terrorists were British boys, as described in Melanie Phillips in her distressing book of reality, Londonistan. Muslim young adults who had been born and were a part of British society and knowledgeable of its values and traditions. Decentralization makes it more difficult for Al-Qaeda to coordinate operations but multiplies the number of independent strikes possible. With Al-Qaeda serving as the head of the global terrorist octopus, each of the tentacles reaching out worldwide become autonomous units. The proposition that all transnational terrorism events are interconnected, though not executed in a coordinated manner, has begun to take on an air of reality. The terrorist octopus is made more dangerous through such decentralization. Al-Qaeda also carries with it the burden to train their operatives in the techniques of intelligence collection, communications, and survival during covert presence and actions in Western countries. These are more than a list of do's and don'ts. Complete manuals on terrorism subject areas and other relevant to terrorist operations are available to jihadists in the West. Among the undercover skills taught is how to go about creating and using forged documents in different names and handling multiple passports and identity cards. The basics of developing alternative escape routes in the event they are needed, as well as techniques for detecting surveillance. The need for training is ongoing since Al-Qaeda continually attracts new recruits to its global network. Some terrorists over time will enter paradise and others will be compelled to operate deeply underground for years before their covert actions are called upon for execution against Western targets. In addition, fresh faces are always in demand. New recruits are often found in prison where they convert to Islam, and, after they are released, to prove their faith by becoming a holy warrior, jihadist. Such recruitment is common in the United States and in Western Europe. Although media speculation is that Al-Qaeda may be attempting to create a blonde-haired, blue-eyed army of jihadists, the reality is that such converts are few in number and useful mostly for propaganda purposes. Islamization in Europe is different than in the United States. Paul Balayan, an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute, writes that the European Union is the primary promoter of massive Muslim immigration in the hope that a Euro-Arab symbiosis can be created. Egyptian-born Bayir, scholar and author of Eurabia, explains that European Union experts believe that such a symbiosis can be created through economic development, soft diplomacy, and multiculturalism, which would guarantee Europe peace. Markets and oil. Although Europeans are extremely worried by the Islamization process, Balayan explains, it is being dictated to them by their political elite against their wishes. Freedom of speech no longer exists in many countries. Laws said to be designed to curb hate speech forbid people to express their concerns about the massive immigration underway and the Islamization of their nations. Meanwhile, violent crimes are increasing, including knifings and rape, many by aliens, and ordinary people are prevented from carrying the means to protect themselves, including pepper spray. When a popular restaurant in a small town outside of Amsterdam closed at 11 p.m., several members of the staff, young women, were discussing whose turn it was to be the designated driver for social activities in Amsterdam. This customer asked why they did not simply take the train. Answer: oh, we used to take the train, but there have been so many rapes and robberies by immigrants recently that the trains are no longer safe. Europeans are also facing official pressures under the Islamization process. In Antwerp, Belgium, a longtime civil servant who had worked in immigrant neighborhood for many years was pushed out of her job by newly arrived Salafist militants. The Salafists first set up youth groups, which were used to take over the mosques. Since they were funded by the Saudis, the Salafists had money and used it in dealing with the Muslim community and city authorities. The Salafists demanded separate hours for Muslim women to use the municipal swimming pools and got their way. Worried immigrants went to the civil servant who had previously helped them before the Salafists arrived and expressed their misgivings. When the civil servant reported their concerns to her superior, she was told to change her attitude. Soon after, she was replaced by one of the radical Salafists. She was also threatened by one of the Salafists of possible consequences if she continued to speak out. Similar tactics have been used elsewhere in Europe where boasting that Western Europe is becoming a hotbed of Salafism can be heard. Islam is Europe's second largest religion after Christianity, and it is the fastest growing, a result of numerous mosque-building programs. From Marseille to Créteil, France, to Rotterdam and Amsterdam, the Netherlands, to Cologne, Germany, and elsewhere throughout the continent. Europeans are waging campaigns against new mosques with their towering minarets against the skyline that dwarf Christian cathedrals built centuries ago. In Cologne, the city's Muslims began building a mosque almost within the shadow of the storied Cologne Cathedral, a landmark survivor of intensive bombing during World War II. The 2,000-person mosque will have twin minarets towering 170 feet. German hostility toward the mosque is met by 120,000 Muslims living in Cologne demanding their right to a place of worship visible to everyone. In the United Kingdom, the European Muslim culture clash took a different direction in February 2008 when the Archbishop of Canterbury called for applying Sharia law in Britain in certain instances. Archbishop Rowan Williams, leader of the 77 million Anglican Communion, said that there was a place for a constructive accommodation with some aspects of Muslim law in the United Kingdom. It is not clear that one can apply Sharia law as if it were sliced up into various units. The Sharia is a very complex legal system that follows the prescriptions of the Quran. The Archbishop's comments created a firestorm of criticism, especially in light of British resentment over the 52 persons killed on July 7, 2005, by 4 bombs set off in the country's transportation system by Islamic terrorists. Prime Minister Gordon Brown issued a statement that said he believed that British law should apply in this country, based on British values. The next day, many bishops joined the politicians in criticizing the Archbishop's remarks and called for his resignation. Some of the bishops claimed that the archbishop was undermining Christian faith. In June 2007, a report by the Virginia-based Jamestown Foundation revealed that jihadi networks and activities in and around Barcelona underscored Catalonia's new status as a European country for Al-Qaeda terrorism operations. The consolidation of the global Salafi jihad in Catalonia, Spain's autonomously governed northern region, underwrites Al-Qaeda's operations in Spain, Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. According to Spanish counterterrorism officials and other terrorism experts, Catalonia has become the principal focus of jihadi terrorism in Spain and the largest recruitment center, some 300,000 Muslims. About one-third of them are from Morocco. Catalonia is the epicenter for jihadi meetings. 3 cities, Badalona, Santa Coloma de Gramenet, and Sant Adrià de Besòs, serve as focal the points of the jihadi triangle for all of Europe. Every month, 3 to 5 Muslim residents travel to Iraq, Chechnya, and Afghanistan. In March 2007, police found tapes by Osama bin Laden and for training in the city of Reyes. The Salafi Islamist groups and their network in Catalonia have established regional operational cells and networks for recruiting jihadis and supporting terrorist activity, including criminal actions to gather funding. The bad news for Europe in the wake of Al-Qaeda's losses in the Iraq War is that at least 200 foreign fighters, jihadists, have been ordered home to Europe. Britain, France, and Spain sent agents to Iraq to determine the identities and scope of the Al-Qaeda blowback. Germany had already detected an increase in the number of Iraqis entering the country. In the meantime, Al-Qaeda operated from North Africa, Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia, in France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands. At the same time, operatives from South Asia have established jihadist cells in Britain and Switzerland. The new European police organization, Europol, issued its first report in April 2007 stating that Islamic insurgency cells pose a greater threat than ever to European security. Religious converts in Europe are playing a growing role in jihadist networks. 2 German converts to Islam, for instance, were arrested while planning to bomb American targets. A convert is among 4 defendants in Copenhagen being tried for plotting to blow up political targets in Sweden. 3 converts await trial in Britain on charges of participating in a 2006 transatlantic airline plot. In some cases, converts feel pressured to prove their worthiness to serve their new faith and make bad decisions. Most European converts are good people who often promote interfaith understanding. But it is the jihadists, a tiny subset of converts, that destroy property and injure people. European converts are of special interest to the Al-Qaeda jihadists, since they can, as a rule, enter the United States more easily. It is not surprising that Al-Qaeda continues to recruit European converts for explosives training in Pakistan. These trained Europeans have an extra edge in inserting operatives into the United States to carry out an attack that might be reminiscent of 9/11. Wahhabi presence in the Balkans is often open and disruptive, since they tend to challenge imams when they do not follow a strict interpretation of Islam. The clash with moderate Islam has resulted in gunfire and fatal confrontations with police. Those people being intimidated by the Wahhabi presence say that they need help against the violence. For the first time in the Balkan countries, people see Muslim women moving around in the hijab, Islamic headdress. This social change is a result of Saudi influence exerted through the Wahhabi presence, including those who marry local women. Saudis pressure Bosnian widows of those killed in the 1990 civil war to convert to Islam. Anyone who converts will be paid $50 per month. Multiculturalism. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the European left adopted multiculturalism as a new weapon to be used on reshaping its own society. a secret partner in the Marxist renewal and re-emergence efforts. Gramsci's cultural transformation strategy was adopted by the left to transform society and, over the long term, destroy capitalism. They went directly from communism to multiculturalism as the continuation of communism by other means, Fjordman, a Norwegian internet blogger, commented. Leftists and Muslims have a mutual short-term interest in keeping leftist parties in power and a mutual long-term interest in weakening the traditional culture of Europe, Fjordman continued. Leftists from all over Europe seem to be opening the gates of Europe from within. You want to conquer Europe? That's okay. Just vote for us and help us get rid of capitalism and eradicate the Christian heritage in Europe, and we will let you in. Fjordman characterizes the European scene. Bettija outlined the Eurabian ideology that envisages a united Mediterranean culture based on a symbiosis of the northern and southern shores through multiculturalism and a unifying process. The idea was to create a common Euro-Arab empire with a free circulation of goods and people and integration structures, such as a common Euro-Arab parliament and universities. Multiculturalism, Bettija says, is in fact a crucial dimension of the Euro-Arab strategic alliance. Fjordman, agreeing with Bettija that the rise of Eurabia is tied to the policies of the European Union, offered a realistic perspective. The tectonic plates of global power are now sifting in ways they haven't done for centuries. This is the retreat of the Western world order. Multiculturalism and the inability or unwillingness of Western nations to uphold their borders are viewed by Muslims as a signal that their ancient Western rival is weak and ripe for conquest. Al-Qaeda strategists have earlier outlined a schedule for awakening the Islamic world and overthrowing the West with a timeline stretching over 15 to 20 years. A world war of sorts with the Islamic world is already inevitable. The only question is whether this will be a cold or hot world war. Islamic multiculturalism, or what ex-Muslim and writer Abdul Qasim calls Kafir Mulet culturalism, Kafir is the Islamic term for non-Muslim, has opened a door for Islamists to turn the West's policies to its advantage. Since the Western concept of multiculturalism includes promotion of religious tolerance, freedom of expression, and democracy, it opens the door for Islamists to advance their agenda to create a pan-Islamic world. All the cardinal principles of Kafir multiculturalism, Abdul Qasim explains, are working in favor of the Islamists. 76. The Islamists support Kafir multiculturalism as a ploy to mask their use of the Western concept as a weapon against itself. The Islamists are delighted to use the West's concepts of democracy, freedom of expression, secularism, and respect for diversity of cultures, religions, languages, and traditions to their advantage. The jihadists have a totally different idea of multiculturalism, Abdul Qasim explains. The foundation of Islamic multiculturalism is solidly based on the supremacy of Islam, primacy of the Arabs, and the global Islamic Ummah community of Muslim believers. When Australia organized an interfaith dialogue, for instance, the Islamists were delighted to share the beauty of Islam. The session and those following were funded by the infidel taxpayers. For the jihadists, such dialogues have served as the best platform to advance Islam in the West. Thanks to those Westerners who are ignorant about Islam and are gullible, useful idiots, Abdul Qasim explains, the Islamists are laughing all the way to the mosque, knowing full well that Islam is totally safe in the hands of Western politicians. The Islamists simply allow the Kafirs to promote the agenda of imposing Islam on the infidel lands. The Quran is clear about Allah being the owner of infidel lands. A few verses from the Quran reinforce the point. Islam is the perfect religion. It will dominate all other religions. 9:33. Allah gradually reduces the land controlled by the unbelievers. 21:44. Allah grabs the land of the unbelievers. 28:58. The believers must make war on unbelievers and hypocrites and show firmness. 9:73. These verses from the Quran are a sample of those making the case that Muslims are the legitimate owners and rulers of all infidel lands. When Islamists immigrate to infidel lands, therefore, they are not entering a foreign territory. Rather, they are simply occupying land that Allah had reserved for them. Europe is dying. The 27-member European Union and the United States are the principal champions in the capitalist West geopolitical competition with Russia and the Islamic Middle East. The main problem is that the Europeans are faltering and unwilling to step out of their downward spiral. European military forces are paper-thin and have shown themselves to be lacking in the self-confidence necessary to engage Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces effectively in Afghanistan. Secondly, the Europeans have given up their Christian heritage, hamstringing themselves from being willing to sacrifice to preserve their way of life. And, thirdly, Europeans live for today, and now as shown by their inability to sustain a birthrate sufficient to sustain the population. In early 2008, the U.S. had to send 3,200 more Marines to Afghanistan to backfill some 20,000 NATO allies, Germany, France, Spain, and Italy, unwilling to risk taking casualties. NATO political leaders insisted that the European forces were up to the task and performing well. Only the Britons and Canadians joined the United States in the heavy lifting against the Taliban. In addition, U.S. officials were adamant that NATO Europe countries had done little to train their military forces for counterinsurgency operations. The reality showed that only the U.S. was willing to risk its forces, more than half of the 42,000 Allied troops, while NATO allies did very little. Yet, in early 2008, only 6 of Germany's 614 parliamentarians favor putting its 2,900 troops in Afghanistan in harm's way. Spain, France, and Italy have also placed restrictions on how NATO may use their armed forces. The reality of the situation is that if the NATO countries are unwilling to step up and do the job needed against the jihad, that alliance no longer serves a useful purpose. The origin of the European disease that is leading it to its dying days is a result of a succession of rulers who were totalitarian in nature. Not only did they want to rule people's day-to-day activities, but it wanted to control their minds and their souls. To do that, following Antonio Gramsci's prescription, there had to be a systematic loss of faith in the Judeo-Christian God, Paul Balayan explains. In real terms, the loss of faith in Judeo-Christian legacy opened the people's minds to the legitimacy of the state as the single source of order. As a result of an ungodly state of affairs, Paul Balayan writes, "Contemporary Europe is in crisis. Its welfare systems are running out of money. Its moral and legal order is breaking down, while the influence of radical Islam is growing. Its nation-states are being undermined by the European Union. Most Europeans look on passively. After three generations of welfare dependency, they have lost the ability to take their fate into their own hands. In what George Weigel has called demographic suicide, the birth rates in Sweden, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany, for example, have fallen as low as 1.4 babies per woman. A 2.1 babies replacement rate is required simply to sustain the current population. At present birth rates, Europe's population will fall by 13% by 2050. During the same period, people of European stock in Europe will be down to 7.5%. Overall, Caucasians that represented 31% of humankind in 1900 will be down to 11% by 2050. Time could run out for Europe. For many young Europeans already aware of living during Europe's final days have made elaborate immigration plans for implementation when the time is right. Many of them have visited friends and relatives in the United States for support of their evacuation from a Europe with a democratic deficit and an increasingly remote and ineffective European Union. Europeans do not enjoy freedom of speech in the same way that Americans do. Many restrictions apply to discussion about Islamization process underway and the large number of immigrants in their countries, but they dare not speak out. If people wish to express their worries about Islamization, they are inhibited by restrictive laws that call such discourse hate speech. The European Union, for instance, banned jihad, Islamic, and fundamentalist when referring to terrorism. Instead of using jihadi fundamentalists, which has been declared a sinful expression, the Eurocrats recommend using violent extremism. Arnaud de Borchgrave concludes the obvious when he writes that the European Union has gradually fallen into the paralyzing embrace of appeasement. America is at war. The simple truth is that the United States is at war. It is a conflict we did not seek, one that we would rather not fight, and one where the path to victory is uncertain. Yet it is a war we must win. The enemy is savage and celebrates his readiness to kill American men, women, and children in the name of God. There is little chance of a peaceful resolution. The war should be expected to go on for multiple generations, since the enemy's religious passions are unrelenting in the belief that Allah compels them to rule in His name over all the world's people. This is the third of the three global geopolitical competitors, militant Islam, whose violent jihad is aimed at Russia and its strategic partners, in the capitalist West dominated by the United States. The winner of this three-way world war will become evident sometime during the second half of this century. The Islamic jihadists will not stop. Killing them, by their own religious beliefs, places them on a fast track to reaching paradise. The capitalist West needs a strength of purpose to protect itself against attack. But Americans are whining and tired of war after just 6.5 years into a decades-long struggle to protect themselves from militant Islam. The 2008 presidential election shows one candidate promising to withdraw U.S. armed forces from the Middle East as quickly as possible in 2009, while the other possible national leader foresees a strategy that keeps American military pressure against those jihadis dedicated with deep religious passion to do America harm. Meanwhile, Europe is faltering and may soon leave the United States standing alone. Mark Stein presents a distressing picture of a Europe that has all but succumbed to the dull opiate of multiculturalism. In its drowsy numbness, it stirs but has no idea what to do, and so does nothing. Is this America's future pathway? The multi-generational war underway has already affected travel on the planet, redirected huge sums of public resources to homeland security, and left numerous people fearful, uncertain, and insecure about their future. The jihadists are wielding a two-sided sword against the capitalist West. One edge is the war's side, the sharper edge that promises endless assaults, bombings, decapitations, and similar great evils. The other is the culture side that uses immigration as a weapon to insert Muslim religious practices into Western countries for the specific purpose of transforming the non-Muslim ways of life into those acceptable to Islam, Chapter 13. The war side of the sword is destructive in the sense the jihadists have met a technological barrier of conventional explosives. Yet, the jihadis are at work on developing or obtaining through theft or purchase an array of chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons. Iraq's murderous leader Saddam Hussein had developed a cookbook for the development of weapons of mass destruction. While Saddam's capabilities to produce and stockpile such weapons have been destroyed, the knowledge of how to build such weapons is common knowledge among the scientific and technological communities in the Middle East. Russia and the capitalist West have a similar fate. It is only a matter of time until these weapons are found in the hands of the jihadists. The difficulty for the West is that such weapons always confer an advantage to the jihadists, since they will always hold the initiative of where and when to execute first use. Tolerating the jihadists is a poor option, for it plays into the hands of their long-term strategy where a combination of the war's side and the culture side of the sword of Islam will meld into a winning position vis-a-vis Russia and the capitalist West. America is at war on two fronts and needs to coordinate its counter-strategies. Placing a continuous military pressure of the war side of the Islamic sword needs to be matched by strengthening U.S. resistance to the multicultural offensive against the American way of life inside the United States. In this regard, Americans have much to learn from the salami tactics that have been used by Muslim immigrants so effectively in breaking the Christian back of Europe. Finally, U.S. policies should take a clear account of the Red-Green Alliance of the Progressive Socialist Marxists, Red, and Wahhabi / Salafism, Green, Color of Arabia, in their mutual support for the transformation of American culture and society. Americans need to give the childish tactic of closing their eyes to unsavory realities and face the fact, as so wisely counseled by George Weigel, the war against jihadism is a contest for the human future that will endure for generations.